In our day and age, we talk in terms which we call scientific terms. And the fundamental elements which we experience throughout our lives to us today mean the different chemical elements, 92 of them as supplied by nature, and about 12 or 13 which are man-made. Not that those man-made elements are scattered through nature, because some of them have a rather short life, a very small fraction of a second. They get produced in the laboratory when we use extremely powerful electrical energies to carry out certain experiments. So we need not concern ourselves with them. But the word elements for us particularly means the chemical elements. And yet, if we are to talk with each other, we would find it extremely inconvenient to talk in terms of the different chemical elements. There are too many, and they haven't the same significance for us as conscious living beings, which the terms earth, water, fire or light, and air have for us. We, as we are constituted physically, psychophysically, are aware of the world around us only in terms of solids, liquids, gases, temperatures, light, atmospheric pressures, and so on. That is all. So for us, we are actually conscious only in terms of earth, water, these being general terms to stand for all solids, all liquids, air, for all gases, whatever they are. And heat and light we class under fire or light, whichever we please. So it is still these elements which really affect our minds. They are in the hinterland of our consciousness, so to say. When we say a thing, we mean primarily a solid object. You can't have a liquid object, because a liquid just takes the shape of the vessel which contains it. And we don't refer to a liquid as a thing. It's only a solid. Still less do we refer to gases as things. Sometimes we do. But if we take this into account, we will see how limited our consciousness is. We are sensitive only in certain very limited ways. Now, let us try and see how and why it is that we are conscious of everything in our lives in a tainted manner. Discriminative consciousness is always tainted by our defects. It also bears the stamp of our good qualities, true enough. But good qualities are no problem. Therefore, there is no need to be worried about them. It is the defects which make the problem. Look back in imagination to our primordial ancestor. He was a creature who swung from the branches of trees. Therefore, his arms played a very great part in the process of living. He was a person whose spine wasn't straight in the sense that our spines are straight. His legs were very strong, very powerful. His jaws were very strong and powerful too. And his arms. The shape of his head was quite different from the shape of our heads. Now that primordial creature, as some distinguished scientists think, gradually took to the grasslands. And when the change was made from swinging from trees and from branch to branch and running across the grasslands, he gradually changed his posture. He became more and more erect. Now one may say, this change of posture, so what? Yes, we know that the animal goes on 4 feet and we go on 2 feet. But there's a great deal to it. Because with the change in posture, stereoscopic vision increased. Not the sort of vision that the four-footed animal has. We have stereoscopic vision with our two eyes because of this posture. At the same time, the sensitivity of our hearing increased. Very significantly and very importantly, the arms developed in a different way, slightly different way, and the hands developed in a very great way. The hands became instruments of great sensitivity and delicacy and skill. See, man has a hand with an opposable thumb, like that, which none of our animals have. And our primordial ancestor didn't have it. Then again, as the posture became more and more erect, the head began to be balanced upon the spine, at the top of the spine, instead of being carried by powerful neck muscles. Now this released the lower jaw. And with the release of the lower jaw, the muzzle became smaller, the skull gradually became bigger, the shape of the head altered, and the brain grew. This is one of the most important things that took place. The brain increased in size. And increase in size of the brain meant many more pathways through the brain cells, an immensely greater potentiality, therefore, for the sort of psychical and mental development which we human beings have par excellence as compared with any animal. Another thing happened. With the release of the lower jaw and the release of tensions in the neck muscles, because they were no longer needed to hold up a fairly heavy head, changes took place in the larynx and our power of speech developed. Stereoscopic vision, much greater sensitivity of hearing, the development of the hands, the growth of the skull and the brain, and the development of speech. These have played the major roles in differentiating us from our primordial ancestor. We have far outdistanced him. Now, all this sounds very attractive. There is another side to it. Our primordial ancestor was concerned with the two fundamental natural urges, the preservation of the self, which meant, of course, obtaining food and drink for himself, driving away a weaker enemy, and running away from a more powerful enemy. He was concerned with the preservation of himself and with the perpetuation of the species. So the whole business of mating, procreating, and caring for the infant as long as the infant was helpless came into being. And all these became instincts. And his life was a life which was determined by conditioned reflexes. Now these things have come down to us and are embodied in our physical cells themselves. The instincts of the animal and the conditioned reflexes are there. And we inherit psychically certain fundamental qualities which are inborn in us. On the debit side, that is debit from the human, the spiritual point of view, aggressiveness, fear, and qualities of that nature. We inherit all that. Our primordial ancestor had no possibility of being self-aware in terms of himself as a whole individual, harmoniously or disharmoniously related to an external universe. We can do that sort of thing. We can think and feel and observe along such lines. Our primordial ancestor couldn't. So we inherit from him some of these traits. Greed, fear, aggressiveness are amongst the outstanding qualities. Now, as we developed, changed physically like this, and developed psychically and mentally, our whole cultural life, as we understand it, came into being. Man began to live more in terms, through the tens of thousands of years, in terms of family and society. man developed memory as no other creature has. And this was the direct consequence of the development of the brain and the erect posture. With the development of memory, he was able to hand down skills. These are not inherited things, remember, like the instinctual activities, animal activities, which animals have, which also exist in us. We do things instinctively. So the moment a baby is born, it's able to suckle its mother's breast, doesn't need any teaching. It does so many things which don't need any teaching. That is transmitted hereditarily. But all the rest, the acquired skills and characteristics, are not transmitted hereditarily, but are handed down through the generations, because we can keep them in memory and hand over. And so, when we look back upon our human history, on the one hand, we find something quite remarkable, monumental achievements, knowledge, skills, techniques, art, science, and all the rest of it. And this may sound very, very attractive. But we must bear in mind that it has been wrested, W-R-E-S-T-E-D, wrested from life at a terrible price in terms of human misery and suffering. All the wonderful monuments that we have and which we go all over the world to see and to enjoy and to appreciate, the building of such monuments has been associated with awful suffering by human beings. All the political, social, economic, educational, and other systems that we have been associated with great cruelty and misery in human life. So we may ask, why is it, how is it, that with this extraordinary development of the brain, all this should be attached to it? Look back upon the fundamental drives of our primordial ancestor. Our drives are no different. There is the drive for self-preservation. There is the drive for the perpetuation of the species. Those two drives in themselves by no means need involve misery, cruelty, oppression, and all the rest of it. But in us, those two drives suffer from two defects. One which is specific to us because we are human beings and does not apply to the animals, and one which does not apply to the animal but applies to us. The animal lived in tune with the rhythm of nature. In the mating season, it mated. We don't do anything of the sort. Our natural drive has become thoroughly indiscriminate. And we are the slaves of it. And we are cruel, oppressive, possessive, demanding, inhuman, bestial, because of it and through it. That is only one example. There are other examples also. How do we obtain our food? Consider the animal. In nature, if you look at a beast of prey, and I mention a beast of prey because one thinks in terms of, oh, how horrible nature, red in tooth and claw, and so forth. But just observe what actually happens in nature. Your carnivorous animal is driven by hunger to hunt for his food. He pounces upon one member of a herd or something, kills it, and then the whole story is over. The herd and he are once again in a state of harmony. We don't do quite that. We do something else. Lots of other things else. So where the animal lives in tune with the rhythm of nature, we have got out of step with nature. And our activities, which derive from this fundamental drive, are associated with so many other elements in our life. And this is all due, of course, to our mental development, memory, and the cultivation of possessiveness, the satisfaction of vanities, of egoisms, and all the rest of it. You know, there's a very great deal involved in it. One can't go into details too much, otherwise we'll take hours over it. But remember the main point. We are not in tune with the rhythm of nature. And the other aspect which is specific to us, which has its roots in our animal origin, is the fact that we are deliberately self-oriented. We have never broken out of that, grown out of it, liberated ourselves from that bondage. For us, the world revolves round ourselves. I and mine are dominant influences in our life. So we are self-oriented. The animal has no option but to be self-oriented. It doesn't know the meaning of self and not self. It doesn't know the meaning. We do. The animal's social life is an instinctual herd life. Our social life is a deliberate, thought-out life together, governed by rules and restrictions, just as animals do have their rules and restrictions, but which all grow instinctively out of life. With us, it is not merely life which determines these rules and regulations, but that which is thought out by us. And all that which is thought out by us has a deliberate self-orientation involved in it. Our ambitions, our conceptions of what particular place in society we have, we ought to have, what is due to us, etc. Our passion to amass wealth for ourselves, to seek and obtain and hold power for ourselves. And the passion to amass wealth, apart from the fact that there is inward fear which seeks security and believes that wealth will bring security, apart from that, it is the gratification of vanities. It is the gratification of self-indulgence all along the line. What does man spend his wealth on? One has to be intensely aware of the fact of the human situation. So you see, this drive for self-preservation has acted in those ways, and the drive for the perpetuation of the species has acted in its own way. And it has left us deliberately self-oriented, whereas the animal is undeliberately, naturally self-oriented. Now we, with our deliberate self-orientation, attempt to establish social orders, which involve, of course, political, economic, and all the other orders which are related to a stable society. We try to establish social orders so that we human beings may realize fulfillment. But surely haven't we missed the real meaning of life for us as human beings thereby? Do we live because of what we do, what we think, what we say, what we feel? Do we live because of all that, or in spite of all that, by and large? Is there any species on the earth which is such a predator, which is so destructive as man is? He has pretty well now got the power to destroy the planet. So you see, the wonderful cultural achievements through the thousands of generations that separate us from our primordial ancestor, all those cultural achievements are vitiated by these difficulties, by these evil things which lie within us. Is it any wonder, then, that we live in terms fundamentally of the exploitation of the elements, earth, water, air, and so forth? We gouge out of the earth's body minerals, because it means wealth, it means power. It means making life easier, as we call it, which is not untrue. It means wealth and power. For what? for our satisfactions, for our pleasure, for our, as we miscall it, well-being. Why do I say we miscall it well-being? Because the minerals of the earth do promote human well-being. But for us, as far as we are concerned, we miscall it well-being because our approach and our attitude is evil. It is possessive, it is exploitive, it is domineering. It is oppressive. It is thoughtless. There is no graciousness in our approach to the earth. Here is coal, let's dig it out. Here is oil, let's get it. Here is gold, here is this, that, and the other. It's all self-oriented in the most appalling way. But you know, if we destroy what would be right, the right ecology of the earth and our whole life on the earth, it will inevitably come back upon us. And it does come back upon us. We can't get away from it. Pollute the air with poisonous gases. We breathe them. There is a penalty. We decree our own karma, so to say. Can't get away from it. Look how the waters of the Great Lakes in North America, look how the waters of the sea are being polluted. See what happens. And we human beings, every one of us in the world individually, is responsible for it. So it's the same with the other aspects too. Fire, if you take fire, in terms of heat, light, and we may in modern times add electricity, electric energy. How do we utilize electric energy, heat energy? How do we utilize it? As we say, for good in certain ways, it's perfectly true, we do utilize them for real good too. But the bulk of it is a misuse, isn't it? I'm talking in terms of our human, or rather, it would be more accurate to say our inhuman attitude to everything, our inhuman approach. See, all this is fundamentally important where living the religious life is concerned. If we don't understand these things, if we are not, and not merely intellectually understand, but if we truly understand, and if we are not sensitive enough to it all, there is no possibility of living the religious life in the real sense, in the living sense, in the creative sense. See also what happens with all the culture that we produce. The grace of life throws up so many geniuses in the world. An artist paints a wonderful picture, embodied transcendence, if you like. Or a musician composes a marvelous work, or something like that. Sheer beauty, sheer loveliness. The peak of human expression, worthy expression. He himself perhaps gets, in the beginning, food, warmth and shelter. If he happens to get better known and well known, he might get 5 times food, warmth and shelter. Sometimes perhaps he uses it rightly. He feeds 5 other people with the food he gets. Oftentimes there is a marvelous display of vanity through entertainment, through this, that and the other. You know the whole story. After he is dead, all the sharks are at work. Now they exploit his products. They sell and they buy and this and that. The buyers who have the wealth buy in order that they may display and so forth. A satisfaction of vanity. And those who sell exploit those who want their vanity satisfied, exploit them, and the price goes up and up and up in 3 centuries, 4 centuries. Embodied transcendence upon a piece of canvas will fetch £500,000. And in order that a person may indulge himself to produce £500,000 for a piece of canvas, what has he done exactly to produce that £500,000? How has it come? Through honorable means, right means? Has he given unto life in proportion? You see, the extraordinary falsity of the values which have crept into our human life to dehumanize it. Beauty is beauty. Can you buy it and sell it? Can you value it? Can you reverence it in terms of possession, in terms of exploitation? You see some of the consequences? Robbery we call a crime, quite rightly. But robbing pictures out of museums and so forth has become an established business practically. So that which was culture in the fine sense of the term, which in its original creation was an embodiment of something utterly wonderful, beautiful and worthy, is now associated with the slime and the horror of human evil. Why? How? It's easy to point a finger and say that fellow's fault, or the fault of this band of wicked brains behind the robbery and so forth. But I am humanity, and humanity, all mankind, is me. I have these things inside myself. True, my primordial ancestor transmitted some of these things to me. Greed and the violence and anger at frustration and so forth, or with competition. 2 males fighting to the death to possess the female animal. It's true that my primordial ancestor transmitted these to me. But I'm a slow learner, aren't I? 2 million, 3 million years have passed. And with my wonderful big head, I've learnt next to nothing. And I still go on perpetrating evil, rationalizing away my sins in the name of family, of society, of the social ideals of honor and justice and peace and freedom and all the rest of it. So in the name of peace, we always find wars. In the name of service and so forth, we always find strikes. So now, where do we go from here? Have we not to see for ourselves that all the elements that compose us are not apprehended by us in purity? We are conscious of a solid, of a liquid, of a gas. We are conscious of earth, fire, air, water, everything, whatever there is. We are conscious of people, of situations, of the beauty of nature, and so on, in deluded terms, in terms which are tainted by our lusts and our ambitions and our greeds and our envies and jealousies and all the rest of it. The root of sin is in my own wrong awareness. I am conscious, greedily, possessively, domineeringly, I was asked to be Lord of creation, to have dominion over the earth and all that it contains. But what is the meaning of exercising dominion, of exercising lordship? Look at the origins of the words themselves in all the languages of the world. He who holds dominion, who is Lord, is the one who is responsible for the well-being of that over which he has dominion. Do we live as creatures who are responsible for other human beings, for the animals, for the trees, for the earth and the waters on the planet? If that were the case, modern ecology, for instance, would not voice such terrible fears about our future. Life would be in a state of harmony, not in a state of terrible danger of extermination. And the thing is that if we do exterminate, we will exterminate not only ourselves, but all creation on the earth. The earth will be a desert. Historically, it's a fact. We have made deserts time and again through our ignorance, through pure ignorance. Cannot be condemned. One doesn't know, one discovers bit by bit. But having discovered, Have we stopped exploiting? Have we stopped being self-oriented, possessive? You see, the present world situation is getting worse and worse, isn't it? There is a peculiar urgency, and it is reaching sinister proportions. The karmic forces which have accumulated through the centuries are beginning to spill over, and it's a destructive tide which is rising. You know how we have been accustomed to say, that sort of thing cannot happen in England. Can't it? Is it not happening? Little dark clouds on the horizon, perhaps big clouds. There is a rising of the winds, which will overcast the land. But do you think you and I can stop it? We can't. And if we are to go down with it, how shall we go down with it? Without fear, without hate, without resentment, pointing the finger of accusation at all the others who brought this about? Because if we do that, we have lived in vain. We have not lived religiously. We are a race mature enough to acknowledge our personal wrongdoing and say, well, I did wrong, this is what has happened. I've got to take my medicine, as we say, or whatever we say. But if you and I, as individuals, have not been, at least, shall I say, so involved with the evil which is slowly bringing this tide of destruction, then will we be able to be human enough, to be compassionate enough, to be religious enough, to be fully awake to our complete involvement with the whole human race. And suffer with it and for it. This is a very important question. We must look deeply into our minds and hearts about this. If we do look deeply enough, so deeply that light comes, we will see that we are unable to be human in the pure and the great sense, in the truly heroic sense, without any heroics about it. The reason why we can't do that is because we are grasping still for ourselves. we grasp at earth, that is, this body of ours. We grasp at water, our own feelings, and the desires to fulfill our whims, our appetites, our passions, our good impulses, any impulses. Because we grasp at air, our thoughts, our ideas, our systems of belief and our philosophies. We grasp at fire, the great principles, as we call them, which drive us and move us to what we believe is good and right action. We grasp at all these things. And we grasp them with all the defects of our conditioning through our animal ancestry, which has been transmitted to us, and the conditioning of our socio-cultural heritage, which is handed down to us through the generations. We must not just think about these things, because our whole thought process is a tainted process. This is very difficult to see, you know. It might sound as if I am just impossibly, hopelessly pessimistic. And you might feel, oh, throw him out of the window into the pond. No, don't. Please, bear with me a bit. Our thought process is a tainted process. Because the process of thought, to be dignified by the name of thought, to be recognized by the name of thought, is a process of speech patterning, which, in order to be coherent, has to have a certain logic attached to it, a logic at the heart of it. Now, this logic emerges out of our whole psychical nature, what we are. Now, am I greedy or not? Am I impatient and resentful, hateful or not? Am I self-oriented or not? You see, all these things determine our thinking process. And our thought process is only the totality of the dead past. You know how it is said in the different religions of the world, thought never added a cubit to man's stature. Thought is not the creative living process. Life is creative. It doesn't think. It is immediately creative. It is utterly spontaneous. But it is neither creative nor spontaneous at the expense of creation. Where the created is now outworn, this creative activity from within transforms the outworn. We as we are, and the way we carry on, are outworn things. We are like reanimated, revivified corpses. And so we eat, we feed upon the living. Life in its purity, in its perfection, in its beauty. That is how the corpse-likeness is maintained. Consider our upbringing and education. Through the ages, it has been the same story. This is how our forefathers lived, thought, spoke, behaved. Thou shalt do likewise. Yes, Mama says, one person, and perhaps one in a many will say, I don't think so. Actually, he wants to say, I don't feel so. But he doesn't yet know the distinction between thought and feeling. So you see, we are conditioned. And we are thrown out into the world like that. Then what happens? We rebel against our conditioning. And we violently try to destroy it. But that is a senseless activity. Because in the mere destruction of what is, we have forfeited, we have forgone our real inward creativeness. The true Creator is unconcerned with destroying what is. The true Creator, in the act of His creation, liberates such an energy that it transforms the old situation. See, we must wake up to the tremendous significance of these things. Then we will not merely rebel and destroy. The mere rebellion is an expression of our resentment, our frustration. It is not an expression of any intelligence or wisdom or compassion or beauty or goodness at all. It is not an expression of the true human in us. It is an expression of the subhuman, containing within himself that which has been transmitted through the thousands of generations from our primordial animal ancestor. We haven't moved ahead. Consider how we have exploited and do exploit and are so stupid in relation to the supreme thing that has emerged out of the human race. It's summed up in those words which have no meaning as far as sense perception and the logical discursive mind can conceive. The word God, the word the Absolute, the infinite. These words are words which are wonderful beyond imagination. They represent the supreme potentiality that lies hidden within each and every one of us. You may call it Christ consciousness if you like, the Buddha nature if you like. Call it truth, call it love, call it goodness, call it anything you like, whatever the sound you make, to represent that which is beyond all restriction, which is transcendence itself. We have done this. That is to say, a few amongst us, relatively few, although they number many hundreds, even within the last 6,000 years, and what is 6,000 compared with 2 or 3 millions? We have done this. A few of us have done it. But the rest of us? Why haven't we woken up to it? What have the rest done? Organized the unorganizable. Or rather, they have raised up organizations in the name of the unorganizable. And we talk about reverence and worship in connection with our religious life. What reverence and worship can there be if at the very root of it all is this irreverent attempt to fixate, to make a tomb for life? Life needs no tombs. It is life. It's alive. Don't think about these things. Feel them. Feel them quietly. With tremendous intensity. You can have tremendous intensity and perfect balance, perfect poise, perfect peace in your own inner being. This is not merely a wishful thought. It is a physical fact. Not merely a spiritual truth. Not only a spiritual truth, it's a physical fact. See what we have learned from modern science as regards the extraordinary and tremendous energies that are locked up in every single atom. And this body of ours alone is made up of 10 to the power 27 or so atoms. That is something like 1,000,000,000,000,000,000 atoms. What immense power of life, what immense energy is there in the body alone. And if we are unawake to it, can we reverence the body? To be wondered at then, that our approach, our attitude, our behavior with respect to the elements is what it is. Now, once again, let me suggest, during the fortnight, coming fortnight, observe all your psycho-mental associations with the elements, which simply means with things, objects, with plants, trees, animals, human beings, organizations, whether they be the business or the school or the factory or whatever it is, situations, events. Examine your psychomental associations and grow in self-awareness. Now you have to beware of one thing. This business of self-awareness is a considerably misunderstood thing. It is restricted very largely to just seeing things as being external to oneself. That's no use. That doesn't get you anywhere. We are still so restricted that we do function in terms of this isolative and separative discriminative consciousness. I, the person comfortably seated here, having had a good meal and a good drink and under no constraint or difficulty or problem or anxiety or anything, am just indulging my intellectual side, looking at, examining this, that or the other, and deluding myself that I am becoming self-aware, growing in self-knowledge. I am doing nothing of the sort. Look, when you are really observant of what we commonly call the external and are really observant and awake to the what we call the internal response in our own minds and feelings, then there is no separation, there is no naming process even. You are it. In the ordinary way, quite naturally, we say, oh, I know what a piano is, I know what a rose is, a book is, a man is, etc. Yes, in an extremely limited sense, this is true. But I really know anything, everything, any person, every person. I really know only in so far as I'm so intensely aware that the isolative self-consciousness is completely out, and in awareness I am it or that person. This is the state of meditation in the supreme sense. This is the real samadhi. Get free of all these petty little ideas which are born of ambition and the passion to achieve and separativeness and all the rest of it, that we go climbing the rungs of the ladder step by step till we become a realized being and a self-realized being and all the names and the claptrap. Use the names and the claptrap to discover that they are names and names only, and not the real thing. The real thing is being. Your primordial ancestor, my primordial ancestor, realized being only in terms of a consciousness of his living body. His feelings, his emotions, his passions, his angers, his satisfactions, when he had his food, when he had his mate. For you and me, it's something very different. That is the old story. It is some millions of years old. With us, it is something totally different. It is awakening in awareness to the totality. Not in thought. That is a string of words. Oh yes, the totality, it's all one. Having said those words, immediately afterwards, I live. That is to say, I think, feel, speak, and do in terms of not unity, but disunity, discord. Isn't that true? Isn't that what the whole human race is doing? And this is nothing, this is not religion. This is not the religious life. The religious life is simply the human life. The being in awareness, which is everything. And then you don't need to be to carry this terrible burden of the knowledge of things, of systems, of philosophies, of teachings. You are it. And you are it, you become it, not by achieving it. This is the point. It is the separative creature, the isolated creature, that strives and achieves. The creature that is not isolated has nothing to achieve. If you and I are one, we don't have to win each other or woo each other. We are one. It is so. How often I have said, I don't seek my nose or my ear, they are there. I don't think about it. I don't have to have any anxiety about it, whether it will remain there. Well, of course it will remain there. Warts and all included. When in awareness the totality is to us and we are to it and in it, in that sense, we are truly and fully human. And then the elements will never be exploited by us, never be misused by us. And perhaps life will be different. If you and I can live like this, the few of us that are here, one never knows what the future may hold. We'll bequeath something, and an ineluctable energy which will transform the psychical atmosphere of the world. Because after all, it is the shining of the sun which outlasts all mists and clouds. And in that transformation of the psychical atmosphere of the world, which includes us too, the right thing, the perfect thing, the best thing will emerge, whatsoever the external event on the face of the earth may be.